Welcome to Agile for All's Humanizing Work Show. I'm Richard Lawrence.
And I'm Peter Green. And we're here with some of the team members from one of my favorite teams of all time, which was the Adobe Audition team, one of Adobe's audio products. So I'm going to introduce folks. This is Hart Schaefer, Paul Ellis, and Ron Day. And I'll hand it over to Richard. I think Richard's going to ask us some questions now, guys.
All right. So how did you end up on a team? What's the backstory for this?
I think Hart was the first. Was Hart or Ron first?
Hart was there before me.
All right, yeah, so Hart, why don't you tell the full backstory?
So we were, three of us were working for Centrillium Software in Scottsdale, Arizona, and we made audio recording and editing software that Adobe bought and repackaged and made into Adobe Audition. And so Peter, Ron, and I were already there and part of that acquisition. But at the time, my job was two jobs at Adobe. So I went from being the product manager at a startup, where I did both the project management and sort of the business side. But at Adobe, that's definitely two roles. And that's when we brought Paul onto the team as our program manager to help with the project management side of things.
All right. Now, this wasn't the first team any of you were on, I imagine, and it certainly wasn't the last team you were on. So what makes this particular one stand out? Peter, you mentioned it was your favorite. Maybe I'll have you start with that.
Yeah, even when before we were acquired by Adobe, it was a really fun culture to work in. So Centrillium was a very cool culture. And so we already had, you know, a lot of the characteristics that make great teams great. We had a really strong shared purpose. A lot of kind of trust between the team members. And I think a lot of that is attributed to some great hiring by Nariman, who hired at least three of us.
Yeah. Directly. Well, he was involved in my hire, too.
And yeah. So some great people on the team.
How about others? What stands out to you about this particular team?
So I think there's two teams, right? There's the Centrillium team that we originally had, and then that team morphed into what we had at Adobe. And I think the fact that we were able to take the core team members that were working on the product originally from Centrillium Software over to work on the product at Adobe when it turned into Audition, I think that was the key, right? Keeping those core team members the same and then bringing on, you know, additional people like Paul and the rest of the cast of the team, I think that was the most important.
Yeah, I think what stuck out for me was the collaborative nature of everybody on the team. It was a great team. And there was a lot of passion about the users, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd never seen that level of sort of dedication to the user experience and getting it right. And one of the things I attribute that to is that all of you guys, and I think most people, came up through customer support at Centrillium.
Yep.
And my background actually also has, I also came from a customer support back in the early days. And I think you get this empathy for customers going through that that it's really hard to get elsewhere. You know, it really puts you right there in the field with the users. And for me, that was like a huge differentiator for this team from other teams. It was just that passion and the focus on the end user.
Mm-hmm. What's an example of where that customer empathy and end user focus showed up for the team that stood out to you?
I remember when we were acquired by Adobe. So we used to have a common practice that developers, testers would actually take support calls, even if that wasn't their full-time role. And it was just how the phone tree worked. If somebody called in, the next available person took it, whether they were customer support or not. Mm-hmm. And when we were acquired by Adobe, we asked to keep that. And we were told, that's not how it works here. We've already got systems in place for that.
Yeah. And
that's an example of, you know, I guess what that is an example of is how important it was to us. That no matter what role you were playing, that direct connection with the customer was still critical. Mm-hmm. And so at Centrillium, everybody, no matter their role, mm-hmm. Was talking to customers and hearing that voice.
Yeah.
What struggles do you remember?
Huh. I mean, I think this actually relates to one of the things that was so great about the team, and one of the things that formed us into a team is that we were literally the only, when we started there, we were pretty much the only software that had to be heard to matter at the company. And it's kind of striking how many times that came up. I remember going to a press demo where all of the products were going to be demoed and there was no way for any of the computers to actually make sound, right? So the press couldn't hear anything. And I actually ran out and on that tour, I mean, I remember telling everybody when I got back about like going to like three different Best Buys in Manhattan to buy every headphone that I could find and plugging them in. But what, so on the team side, that was really, we gelled because we knew that we had a mission, we knew what our customers were doing, and that we really felt like we were fighting the whole world in order to actually accomplish that, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so starting with the shared purpose and sort of the external pressure there, that was you know, for, like helped gel us as a team. Mm-hmm. Then the big challenge that came with that was that we knew who our customers were, we knew what we were trying to do, and it was really split with what some of the rest of the company thought we should be doing, and a lot of the time we had pressures from outside that were telling us to concentrate on people that, well, and it wasn't even people that we didn't think mattered, but in ways that we didn't think mattered from our contact with the customers. And that was, I think, one of the fundamental struggles that I had was trying to balance our, you know, our focus on what the rest of the company was looking for and what we knew was kind of the right thing to do for our customers.
Yeah. So trying to figure out where we fit. I mean, that's the biggest thing initially, because we knew who we were, like you said. We knew who we were trying to, we were making software for these specific customers, right? People in radio and podcasts, and these are the people that we've been talking to. They're our customers. And then you move into Adobe and you realize, well, the focus is a little different, right? Yeah. What they're expecting is a little different. Mm-hmm. I think shifting that around and getting the people that have been working with, at Centrillium for so long to kind of, you know, jump into that new mindset. So
I think there's a germ there, a seed that helped contribute to the unique environment of the team, which is Adobe, a visual company, like you said, mm-hmm. perfect example, you know, all about images and graphics and font. And it was this little audio engine that could on the side. Yeah. That allowed the team to have a lot more autonomy, right? Mm-hmm. And that's obviously an important motivator for everybody. We could get away with a lot more innovation and doing things that were sort of outside the pale at Adobe because we weren't really the most important product there, mm-hmm. right? And that's really unique position to be in.
And that was actually, like, we got good at landing exactly what we needed to do for the rest of the company enough that then we were left alone. And then we were able to actually function fairly autonomously after figuring out what it was that we needed to do to make everything else come
together. That's right. There's a navigation there between, well, you got to pay your dues on the corporate side, but then you can innovate on this side, and the closeness of the team to the customers allowed us to do that, I think.
I think there's a real tribute that needs to be paid to some of the leadership there. I think of Erica Schisler, and I think of Bill Hensler, and Simon, and folks that were willing to create some space for us to do cool things. That I don't know that other teams got that leeway. Maybe they did, but I think they did a great job from a leadership standpoint of giving us direction and outcomes that they cared about, but then getting out of the way and saying, oh, you want to do this crazy new way of doing software development? Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember being greeted with a bit of skepticism when we were like, well, we want to take on this new process. But, you know, again, we had a little bit more leeway than other teams. Mm-hmm. We weren't the marquee product. They could use our test bed to experiment with some things that may or may not work or a little bit more risky.
So this new process was Scrum, right?
That's right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So what did adopting Scrum change for your team, and maybe how did you come to adopt Scrum?
I can talk about how we came to adopt it, which was that as soon as I was made a program manager for that team, so Paul moved over into engineering management, I moved in over into program management, and almost the week that I got the program management title, all these meetings showed up on my calendar, which maybe is not surprising for anybody that's been a programmer project manager, but one of those was a series of lunch and learn meetings where once a month they'd bring in some external speaker. And the first one I went to that very first week was Jeff Sutherland, who invented Scrum. And we had just completed Audition 2, which was a hard, huge release.
Yeah.
Basically a full rewrite of the product, back end, front end.
Yeah.
And as Jeff described Scrum, I kept thinking, oh, if we had done that on our team last cycle, this would have been so much easier. And that would have really helped us do that. And so I went and talked to these guys and said, hey, have you guys heard of this? Would you be interested in doing it? What do you think? And we read some books, and we read some blogs, and we were all, and the funny story about, Paul mentioned there's a little skepticism. When I gathered the team together, because I was going to make the pitch to say, hey, I think we should do Scrum. And Bill Hensler, who I think at the time was our director of engineering, was on the call. He wasn't in person that day. He called in. And I remember getting about 2 minutes into the meeting, and Bill saying, hang on, on the phone. And, yeah, Bill, what do you need? And he said, Peter, do you have any experience using Scrum? I said, no, I don't have any experience. Have you had any training in how Scrum works? I said, no, yes. Okay, this meeting's over. Yeah. Said, you can reconvene the meeting when you've had some training. So yeah. Paul and I went and got certified Scrum Master training from Ken Schwaber. In 2005. Yeah. Then we came back, and then we ended up doing some training for the full team. So that was kind of the adoption part of it.
Yeah.
I love that story about Bill, though, because totally supportive, but he's not just going to say, do whatever you want, right? He's saying there's a right way and a wrong way to do things, and probably just flying off and doing something that you've just heard about, maybe not the right way, maybe get some training.
And Peter was a little green, right?
A little bit. No pun intended.
He was new and excited and had a lot of passion to shake things up.
But
I remember that, like, that Jeff Sutherland pitch, it was like hit all the points that like we were feeling the pain on.
Yeah.
It was quite a journey.
So then you got started with Scrum, and how did that change things for your team?
Changes things pretty dramatically. So I come from the test side. I was originally in tech support and then moved into testing the software, both in Centrillium and then for Adobe. And in the waterfall process that we followed before, it was mostly, here's a spec, the developers will work to the spec, and then when they're done, they hand it off to the test team. Now, the test team's got a certain amount of time to test at the end of the process, but they're not involved at the beginning. Like, there's no involvement, there's no conversations at the beginning. How things are supposed to work and how they tie in together, the spec doesn't show you that, right? So we were always at the end just like, okay, here it is, and let's file bugs, and sometimes those bugs are, nope, that's the way it works. Like, that's the way we developed it. Well, did you guys really think that through? Because it doesn't work really well.
That doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So we ran into that kind of a problem all the time. Scrum changed that by bringing the testers into the very beginning of the process, right? It's a partnership between the test team and the development team and the designers and PM and all of that. So for testing and for QE, it was a major step forward. I can't imagine going back now, so I'll tell you that much.
Mm-hmm. Was it hard for testers to engage at that point?
No, at least the testers that I have been working with and had worked with at the time were ready for that. I mean, they wanted to be heard at the very beginning of the process. Mm-hmm. Having things handed off to you at the end and trying to figure out, is this expected? Is it a bug? That's very hard. It's a very hard way to work. And at the end, you feel like you have no control.
And I do think that that's partially when we go back to the customer engagement that the team had, that I have worked on other teams where that's been more of a challenge, where people who aren't used to that kind of thinking. Mm-hmm. But on our team, again, in retrospect, I had no idea that we had it relatively easy in that transition. The team was already thinking, not necessarily iteratively in the way that Scrum and then later other agile thinking
encourages.
But definitely that customer focused and the thinking in terms of, like, we already thought in terms of stories almost. Like our features were already more user centric than engineering centric, just in the way we were working. And a lot of that was already coming from our quality assurance team.
That's right.
How did it change your role as product manager to product owner there?
You didn't do any work after that.
That's right, exactly.
I mean, we talked about, like, so a lot of what we did was we had what we called the feature council. And so when we were talking about the things which are technically certainly the backlog management, it was very collaborative. And I definitely, as the product manager and product owner, led that effort and would make decisions that were, again, in collaboration with the team, but we're about the large things we needed to do, especially coming back from, well, these are the company requirements that we have, and this is what we need to do to support the other products in the then suite of products that we were part of. And then work with the team about filling in the rest. And
let me stop you for a second there. Were you still getting requirement documents from somewhere else, and then you were translating these to a product backlog? Or when you say requirements, was it more high level, this is what other products need from us?
Both, although it was not luckily, I was talking to the guys a little bit before we started today, and I was doubly lucky at that time because also the product management team I happened to be on, the other product managers of the other products that were in the suite, was also one of the best teams I had ever worked on. And again, I had no idea how good I had it then. And so, but that team was very collaborative about, well, what are we going to do as a group of products? Mm-hmm. And so there were some things that I just had to come back and say, this is just a spec, we just have to do it. But mostly I was able to take the team's concerns to the product managers and come to some detente there, But then ultimately we did have, as Paul put it, a tax. Although, again, when we really started to understand what the suite was after, it was much easier for us to buy into that as well. It's like, oh, well, the audio part of this needs to be this sort of thing.
Yeah.
So for me personally, professionally in Scrum, one was sort of formalizing and having a better understanding of how we were going to approach this. So I didn't feel like I was just making stuff up in the same way that I did before, because I knew I was going to write a story, I was going to help with the team writing a story. But the other thing that was really powerful for me was that a lot of my time was forced to be away from the actual team. I was on the road, I was in other engagements for the marketing and product management team, and by having a feature council and having sort of that shared alignment, I could be gone and then know that the team was continuing to move along in exactly the same way and come back and look at the feature backlog and so on, and really distributed some of that responsibility.
You know, I think that feature council was one of the distinct elements that made our team successful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I've never seen it anywhere else quite like that. Mm-hmm. Again, because everybody brought their own perspective. It was like, the jury, each coming in from like the QA side, the engineering side, the product management side, the program management side, the core team coming together with their own viewpoints, working super collaboratively together to manage what the thing was going to be.
Right.
And I don't think I've ever seen that many different individuals come together so successfully on a so-called feature council.
Well, it seems like in most places the engineering and QA side isn't treated as if they have a useful perspective on.
That's right, on the features as we're going. And it was so critical to us because we were thinking about what the outcome was going to be long before we got there. And so like when we're saying, that's a really hard feature. Well, or that's a really easy thing to do, and quality assurance could say, that may be easy to implement, but it is not easy to test because of the
implications. Think about these things.
That's right. Or somebody would say, oh, I'm afraid of the implications. Like, actually, that's really easy. We've got a test bed for that. We're all set up.
Right,
And, we used to talk about how, as the product owner, I had sort of the tiebreaker. Like, if we were deadlocked, I would make the call. And and this is the thing, I think I did that, but I don't actually remember the instances. I'm pretty sure that it happened, but I think that if it did happen, it was extremely rare, and I can't even remember the times that it did.
Yeah,
I agree.
What effect did what happened on this team have on the larger context, the organization, the other teams around you?
I think they started to look to us. I mean, we were using it as an example. I know many times in many conversations that I was a part of, we started to get, hey, look at how the audition team is functioning.
I remember an all-hands meeting where somebody said, well, we can't possibly do that.
And yeah, it wasn't an all-hands.
It was a...
So this was Chisholm?
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so this was at a concept accept meeting. So essentially the leaders of each of the Creative Suite products got together and we were looking at what the next release was going to look like.
Yeah.
And there was an idea for a new product. And so we had used Scrum to build Sound Booth, which was a 1.0 audio product. It was a different user than we had built for before. So it was a wholly different brand, wholly new code base. Mm-hmm. And we had gone from idea to shipping 18 months later. So we were now in the next release. We were sitting in this meeting, the CEO, the executives, the leaders of all of the teams were there, and somebody was talking about a new 1.0 product that they were thinking about building. And I remember them saying, will it be ready by the end of this release? And the leader of that effort said, oh no, it's gonna take at least 3 years, it's a 1.0 product. And I remember Bruce Chisholm, who was the CEO at the time, saying, well, what about Sound Booth? Didn't they do it in one release? And it went down the chain. Bruce turned to Bill. Bill, what was that process used? And Bill turned to me and I said, it was called Scrum. And Bill said, Bruce, it was called Scrum. And then Bruce turned to that developer and said, why don't you guys look at Scrum as a way to do this faster? Yeah. That's one example. I remember when we got to, the rest of the products we're using, still a pretty waterfallish software development process, which really meant out of 18 months, you got 12 months to do product development, new feature development, and then 6 months to fix all the bugs you created and to figure out the integration and the packaging and all that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And we got to that 6 month date, and we had no idea what we were going to do for the next 6 months because we were shippable at the end of every sprint.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the long story
almost,
short.
Like, almost.
Yeah. Well, close enough. But we're like, clearly we don't need 6 months.
We don't need 6 months. Yeah.
We didn't need that much time.
Like, if we were feature complete right now, we'd be shippable. Like, we'd be really comfortable shipping in a month.
That was a huge, huge paradigm shift that none of the teams at that time were executing in that way. Yeah. And we hoped that would be the end result, but we didn't know. So in that first release, we did bank for the full waterfall, you know, period of time for that QA process in the end game, but we didn't need it.
We didn't need it, and we had to kind of get permission to even use some of it.
Yeah, that's right. To add new features, right?
Yeah. So we had a we had one testing sprint just to make sure we could get it all the way done.
Yeah.
Which is not actually a sprint. But we did spend the equivalent of a sprint just testing and reducing bugs, and got it down to okay, we're good. So then we got 2 more months of feature development time. The other thing that happened is that the other teams all had that monstrous bug curve to try and clean up at the end of their release. And so I remember we were doing a Friday barbecue maybe a month or two before the whole suite shipped. And we were out on the beautiful lawn out in the Seattle office at Adobe. And we were out playing wiffle ball. We had a weekly tradition we called Friday barbecue. Yeah. And so for Friday barbecue, we got some food and we went down and we played wiffle ball. Because we're like ready to go. We don't have anything to do for the next month. We actually, I think we're planning our next release.
Yeah, planning,
And so we were kind of taking it easy. And I know that there were other teams that were involved in that Creative Suite release that were not in such good shape. And they were doing like mandatory Saturdays.
Oh, yeah.
And so we were out there playing wiffle ball on Friday. And the other teams are watching us from the window saying, what?
How's
And so things like that, you know, create some curiosity. How did they do that? We're in the same, we should be in the same boat here. How do they have time to play wiffle ball a month before we ship?
Curiosity probably wasn't the feeling.
Well,
animosity, maybe?
A little bit.
Maybe later.
Yeah, it turned into curiosity soon enough that I had program managers coming to me at the end of that release and saying, all right, tell me about this Scrum thing.
What has the personal impact for you been of having been on that team?
I'll say that one of the personal impacts is 11 years since I've been on that team, I can get together and see these guys and it's like we've been hanging out the whole time. So really lifelong friendships has been one of the really rewarding things about being on a team like that. You go through battles together, you kind of, we're brothers for life.
That's right, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and I feel like, I mean, I joke sometimes I'm spoiled for other teams, but the way I think of it now is, so I have my own company now, and I have extremely high standards for what I want to try to build. I care so deeply, because I know it's possible to have a team that functions like this team did, and even better. I mean, we were young and inexperienced, and we had a lot of external factors that helped it become sort of just happened to be awesome, and so now I think a lot more about building intentionally awesome teams. And because I know it's possible, I know how good it can be.
Yeah, I think it's that possibility for me, you know, when I thought about what was the impact from being on that team, it opened up the world of possibilities in software development. It was like so fundamental to me that I can't even imagine going back to the old way of doing things. And you know, you think about how do you recreate the good elements that we had on that team so that we can do it again. And it's when work becomes joy. It's when it's not the strife, it's the struggle for excellence, right? Which is totally different. It's completely influenced how I think about software development.
And it is that standard. It's trying to make sure that, you know, with every team you work on or every product you work on later, you want to bring that back. You want that same experience. And it's hard because I can't say that I've had it with the other teams that I've been on. You know, maybe it's a mix of the people in the process, but everybody's bringing their own process to the table too, right? Mm-hmm. Especially you have people that are coming in from different companies. They've got their own viewpoint. You know, Scrum is what Scrum is, but everyone's got their own definition of how it's supposed to work or how they've used it in the past and what agile development really is. And that's hard sometimes too, right? You're trying to influence based on your previous experience, just like they're doing, but I know it worked. It worked well, right? So
So there's a temptation after an experience like this to try to recreate the experience again in a different context, which usually doesn't work because of the different context. Yeah. So what are some of the things that you've been able to take away from that and apply elsewhere that have stood up to variations in context?
And there's a lot of pieces of the process that have translated well to other teams. You know, I'll just use one example, like planning poker, right? It's a really successful technique that works well in all teams.
Peter's shaking his head over there.
But it's funny because you go to new teams and you pick up new tricks and like I saw a new version of that, you know, just this year. And I was like, okay, that brings some new elements to it that I hadn't considered before. So, you know, it's a mixed bag. You try to recreate the good, but in interacting with new teams and new team members, you get an infusion of new ideas, which is also super like exciting and rewarding, and you can cobble together new ways to be successful. It'll never be the same, right? But you can be very successful in different ways, right? So
I think the parts of the process, I can't really pinpoint the parts of the process, but there are a lot of things that we did back then that I could say, you know, on a daily basis, we try to, you know, do the same things. We make sure that the feature council's in place, that we're having the right conversations about feature priorities. We're making sure the team feels involved. And it's not just, you know, management coming down saying, here's how you do it. Nope, we want the team to impact how it's done. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think that we've been able to, at least on the teams I've worked on, been able to carry that along.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, for me, even more than the individual. So I was in software for a while after, but the last 8 years I've not been in software at all. And a lot of the fundamentals still hold, even not doing product development in the same kind of way. But the thing that I take most is really just, I don't care how talented somebody is. Like, I'm looking for a team orientation. I'm looking for people, and I want to be surrounded by other people who care about making the team work as much as I care about making the team work.
Yeah.
And really when it comes down to it, I mean, people talk about all these like no jerk rules and all this kind of stuff, but you can't actually know that. But you can look for and spend the effort and know that no matter how much we're getting out of that person, if they're not coming with the idea of the success of the team in mind, it's never going to be a great team. It's never going to feel good. It's never going to have that same oomph. And I remember talking to Peter, and this is one of the things that got me into coaching and doing some of that other work, is that, right, the being on a good team is an order of magnitude better than being on a good person, which is an order, you know, which is better than being a normal individual contributor. And so, like, I can believe it, and I can also know that it gives me sort of the confidence to try to steer away from those, as somebody's recently taught me, talented terrors.
Right? So, yeah, it's you know, shared values, right, is the key. And we happen to have a circumstance where we came together and we all shared certain values, you know, passion for the customer being one, passion for learning and improvement, mm-hmm. right? That was another shared value.
Respect for each other, like that there were a lot of teams that we could get stories from about like people starting to yell at each other and throw things.
Yeah.
And like we got passionate. Like I was famous for pounding on a table, and I still am. But like I don't think that anybody at that table ever thought that I was yelling at them or was going to throw something at them, right? Like
it was
passion about the customer, about what we should do, about what was going on.
Right.
But it was never at each other, and we all knew it. And so it's part of the core of trust.
Yeah. You walk out of that conference room and you know you're all good. Even though maybe you had some disagreements, but you...
Well, if it didn't feel good, you wouldn't talk to the person. Like, I mean, that was always the good thing. Yeah. Like that was true. And that was a huge part of... I mean, if we go back to why the team worked, is sitting down in the office, like, and we didn't have the tools that certainly I feel like I do now, but it was like, I didn't feel good. What just happened in there? And we didn't let that go. And so that's also stuff that still comes up.
Yeah. I do remember on one occasion, though, you crushed a water bottle pretty hard. I do remember that water bottle didn't survive. We were all fine with it because it wasn't against us, but it was,
Well, that's the other thing, is I think that there was a lot of, like, they knew that I had a lot of trouble with that external stuff, right? And so I knew that my team had my back because I felt like a lot of the time we'd end up getting together and then I had to go fight something. And you did too, in the program management side, like go fight the battle somewhere else. And I knew that the team knew that even if I came back with not what we wanted, that I had done the best and that you had done the best. Like, and we were all in line that way.
And the battle wasn't in the room. The battle was outside the room and we were trying to,
Yeah, exactly. So we were definitely, you know, and so anytime that like that kind of thing happened, it was not about us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What advice would you have for our audience, you know, people who are on teams, leading parts of organizations who want to create or maintain a culture like you're describing from the this period of the audition team, what are some practical things that they can do?
I mean, hiring is key. And, you know, a lot of times a team gets kind of overwhelmed and there's always more work than you can possibly handle. And sometimes you get a little desperate. Mm-hmm. And it's really important, the most important decision you can make is this person a good complement to the team, right? And the way you think about that has to be complementary, not the same, right? Mm-hmm. It's really important to have differing points of view, differing strengths, comes together like puzzle pieces, right? Into a holistic team. So you don't want just, you know, all A-type personalities all on the team. And that's really hard to do. Like, that's why you said practical. I don't know how to do that. I can't tell you how to hire well. I can only say, you know, take your time and be careful and think about how their personalities, their strengths, their passion, where is it in alignment with your team and where is it complementary where you have a gap? Like, that's super duper important. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those soft skills really hard to do right.
And I know that, Hart, you've been experimenting and practicing on the hiring side, so maybe that could be a future episode if we talk about, you know, in the humanizing work themes, how do you hire for somebody that's going to be a good complement to these teams?
That's right. It's it's incredibly difficult. And I think that just as more difficult is firing well, right? That if you are a leader and you're actually looking at your organization, your team, that again, back to that talented terror, it's really difficult to, as a leader, say, to prioritize that person has a lot of output that helps our organization, but they're damaging the teamwork. And it's a leap of faith to say, oh, that's actually more damaging overall than what they're giving me, because you can see what that individual is giving you, and it's hard to see.
Yeah, that short-term game versus long-term.
That's right, and it's like it's the invisible versus the intangible, or the tangible versus the intangible. But just know that if somebody is damaging the way the team is functioning, is hurting that trust and that comfort of the team, it has to be hurting more than that one person could possibly be giving you.
Now, for people who have the people they have, they're not in a position to focus on hiring and firing. What advice do you have for them?
I would say make sure that you're involving the team in the process. Again, I think Scrum is, you know, it's just one of those practices that encourage that, you know, where it's not just about the managers making decisions and the team executing. You know, involve the team. If you're talking about software development, involve them with your customers and make sure they understand why they're doing what they're doing, and get them that visibility at the upper level so that they know what's happening, why it's happening, why they're doing everything day to day, and what the customers really want, because then they'll be passionate about it. So I think that if you've got the right people, they'll latch on to that.
And similarly, I think that be explicit about what your purpose is, what your mission is, why you are a team, why is it that this group is together. I think it was so fundamental to us to know that what we were trying to do, and knowing where that is, and just people, like when combined with actually being involved, empowered, being able to make real decisions. The combination of that plus knowing where you're going, it's worth a lot of effort to get people on the same page that way.
I couldn't agree more. I think, you know, you get a lot of skepticism about, oh, it's a mission statement, vision statement, what a waste of time.
Because it's been done so poorly by so many.
That's right. Well, we've all had the mission statement, which is just, which is demonstrably BS, because whenever
it's
a decision...
word salad.
Well, because whenever a decision is going to be made, the mission is nowhere to be found.
Exactly.
Like, you know that the real mission is whatever it comes down to when a hard decision has to be made, right? But we knew that when we were choosing between two things that we needed to do on that team, we knew how we were going to tilt, and that was our mission.
Right, yeah. And it all filters down from there. And every individual that you empower, that you give that autonomy to, is looking up that sort of chain of objectives, you know, mission, vision, and making a decision on a day-to-day basis. So if you don't give people those things, those guideposts, they're going to they're going to waver, falter, they won't know where to go.
Well, that's what starts to create, like, if it's a lot easier to keep people in respectful conversation and mm-hmm. all the other things that are like that we talked about as far as, you know, not directed at not being mad at each other and mm-hmm. and really talking about the things if you're all aligned on the same mission, because you can get really, really passionate without feeling like it's you and I disagree. It's not that you're stupid, right?
Yeah, right.
And it's a lot easier when you know that the other person is pulling in the same direction that you are.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a place where constraints are actually helpful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that fit within our mission, right? Is that one of the key objectives we're trying to achieve this month or this quarter? And you can sort of discard a lot of noise and argument about right. things that don't matter.
Well, mm-hmm. and then I'd say, like, again, if you're not a team leader, then knowing, like, why does the mission that we do have matter to you and yeah. to you and to
yeah,
you,
absolutely. Right? Exactly.
Because knowing yep. the like, my mission doesn't have to be to empower musicians, right? Like, I was really fired up about making great software. I was really fired up about enabling new, never before possible things for our customers. And that doesn't have to be the same reason, but like knowing yeah. how I'm tied into the mission and then also yeah. knowing how my teammates are tied into the mission, mm-hmm. yeah. I think is a critical thing. And you don't need anybody to find that out. Like, you just go start asking your teammates,
yeah.
like, why do you work here? Like, you're yeah. a talented person. Like, what fires you up and what makes you excited about it?
Yeah.
How about you? And if you're having those conversations, you can make an enormous difference with how your team feels just yeah. by having those conversations with your teammates.
Yeah, yeah. This is key. Like, when you come into a new team or you're bringing a new team together, understanding what motivates each other on the team and how that ties together to your singular yeah. purpose, right? Super duper important, because then you know what you're arguing about if right. you're having
and
a disagreement.
Where people are coming
that.
From.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, if I know that you know, Hart, the thing that gets him most excited is building some new cool thing. And I'm gonna say, Hart, our customer really wants this and it's not a new cool thing,
that's right.
but they really need it. I know it's gonna be a different kind of conversation than, hey, Hart, I think we could patent this because nobody's ever done it before. That's going to be a really easy conversation.
Yeah, right.
The other one, I'm going to go into it knowing, all right, I'm going to really have to connect this to what I'm passionate about, which is these musicians trying to get this outcome done.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, I think this is exactly where when your team has one of those, what everybody feels like the BS team building thing, mm-hmm. right, where like forced happiness, like go on the picnic thing, right? That's the rough simulation yeah. of what we're talking about
yes.
here. Because the
yes.
other thing about it is that, like, if you actually socialize with your coworkers and you know what's going on at home and things like that, it's you know, people can bring their whole self to work, which is just the mm-hmm. next layer of that, which is the mm-hmm. thing that companies are constantly trying to, like, take the shortcut and force by saying, okay, well, now we're going to have this.
We're going to want a retreat.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Yeah. Or potato sack races.
Yeah, or have the forced picnic falls. Where we're going
to you're not going to build empathy and understanding through your trust fall yeah. exercise. So.
But then if you already have that a little bit, or you've got something that can be really powerful in the way to build that, if you're actually learning something about each other mm-hmm. and why you're there. And it's just it's like all those retreats are like just the cargo cult of the actual thing, mm-hmm. which is understanding each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And when you do find those right people and you've got the right fit on your team, you have to make sure that you do get them involved in everything that's going on in this way. And if you don't, you're going to lose really good people. Then you're back to the beginning trying to find the
Absolutely.
People, and that's the hardest part.
Well,
right?
And that's the last thing I was going to say exactly to that. It's like any good relationship, which is that you don't meet somebody and get married and now you're set, right? And it's good. Like,
yeah.
like good marriages, good relationships of any kind take work and input.
Yeah.
And what work that is, I think, is different. Like, I couldn't say here's the like laundry list of things you need to do,
yeah.
but it's thinking, well, I found it. And so now what's making it good, being conscious of that and actually spending any conscious energy at all to figure out what it is that made it good
yeah.
and to try to keep making it good.
Yeah. There's a specific example of that on the audition team, because we had our team in Seattle, and then we had an acquisition or a new team that came in from Hamburg, Germany, mm-hmm. right? And so you have a group of people that worked together in a certain way for a long time and another group that worked differently for a long time. And of course, inevitably, you know, there's that initial clash yeah. of cultures, yeah. you know, really, because yeah. the way we worked was so different. And I remember that we struggled with that for a long time until, like, for me, the light bulb went off when I read an article about how US engineers solve problems versus how German engineers solve problems. And I was like, oh, I see. That's why we're always fighting. Mm-hmm. Because we think about it and we come at it from a different angle.
Yeah. Yeah.
But once we were able to sort of acknowledge that and bridge that, then the teams became super collaborative and were able to be successful and bring their own like excellence in different areas together.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that was a true crucible, I think, for the team.
Absolutely.
I think that we were able to make it through that.
Yep.
Guys, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about this. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Yes, thank you.
And thanks for joining us on another Humanizing Work Show episode. We'll see you next time.